geekspeak.com. You are listening to Geek Speak. In the air room, we're going to have Miles Elam, Sean Tracy, Sean Cleveland, John Tracy. I knew that sounded strange. And we have special guest Mike McKay. Michael is a consumer advocate. He's also involved in community organizations. He's on the board of the Santa Cruz Brook Festival. But what he is kind of interested in, he's also a programmer, his interest is copyright. So we're going to be talking about copyright, and because it's Geek Speak, we're going to be talking about the digital realm of copyright and what is current and what is going on. Please keep in mind the views expressed on Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. During the second half of the show, I'm going to invite you to call in and join our discussion. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free in California, 1-800-655-5877, and that'll be during the second half of our show. Michael McKay, thank you, and welcome to Geek Speak.
Well, thank you.
You were on before, and we talked about, what did we talk about before? Encryption.
That's right.
Yes. But this time we're talking about copyright and laws, and you brought in a little bit of expertise on some of the bills that are pending, but let's start talking about why was copyright created, what does it mean, where are we at right now?
Yeah, it always helps to have an overview of copyright. I've heard it said that the only thing more complicated than the copyright code is the U.S. tax code.
But copyright stems from a concept of wanting to promote the culture and the arts and the sciences of the society. And so patents are one form of protection, trademarks are another, and then copyrights, which are the subject today.
Now, you say it's designed to enrich the community or the society, but it actually grants one person ownership of something that they created or something that they first copyright.
Right. Well, what the principal method that they use to grant that right or to do that is they give a temporary grant of monopoly. And so the monopoly is on the way that it's on the if you think about a book, this is one of the first copyrights only applied to books, and then over the years they've expanded out.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is copyright gives the people the ability to do a number of things. Copyright is, some people take it too literally. It doesn't mean that you can't make copies, but it does mean that, for instance, for books, you can't publish and sell copies unless you are the holder of the copyright.
Okay.
And
so this monopoly is given to the author or the publisher first time out. What does that enable for the society, though?
All right. So the benefits to society, first, is it gives the authors an incentive to actually create these items. And so if you were to write a novel and know that as soon as you publish the novel, there'd be 20 dozen knockoffs going, and that you wouldn't make any money from that, you might be not inclined to put the effort that it would take to produce the novel.
Okay.
So that's on the benefit side to the author and the creator. Then society benefits by having that creation, but then at some point the author doesn't actually have all control over that. And so by keeping certain rights, giving those to the publishers, and certain rights that are kept, for instance, there's a copyright term that the author only has so much time to control this monopoly.
Okay. Well, where are we now with copyright?
Well,
is it true that copyright only exists for a certain period of time still?
Yes. Effectively, when copyright first started in the creation of the U.S., the original term was 14 years, and then they could renew it once to get an additional 14 years. In the last 100 years, the terms have been extended 11 times, and so it's now up to two different circumstances. If you are just a normal person writing it, it's your term of life plus 50 years. If it's, plus 75 years.
Wait, your term of life? You mean
so
your life?
Your life plus 75 years. If it is written for hire, so in other words, say I'm working for Disney and I write a story and Disney takes that, then it's just a flat 95 years.
95 years? Isn't that pretty excessive?
I think the general feeling is that is excessive, and as I was saying, it has been increased 11 times in the last 100 years.
Wow.
There's a recent Supreme Court case, the Eldridge hearing, which kind of goes that the last time Congress extended the copyrights by an additional 20 years, including retroactively. So
that was the Sonny Bono Act, right?
That's right. Yeah. And so that's sometimes called the Mickey Mouse Law, because every time Mickey Mouse is about to go into the public domain, they extend it out.
You mean the actual character Mickey Mouse?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, the first appearance of Mickey Mouse was in 1923, as I recall. And so in 2003, he would have got the Steamboat Willie cartoon would have gone into the public domain. Actually, it must have been 33. Okay. Mm-hmm. Until they passed the Sonny Bono law. That's also an interesting point. The way that that law was sold was, well, we're going to normalize our copyrights with Europe. And we have this WIPO treaty, and the WIPO treaty doesn't really have people look at it for the most part. It's just businesses getting together and saying, okay, this is how we're going to do things. Mm-hmm. Well, then they went to Congress and they said, oh, hey, look, WIPO says that we should have this time of term, so...
But WIPO was companies that were interested in holding their copyright.
That's right.
Interesting.
So, yeah, there's a whole lack of citizen involvement in copyrights, I think, which is largely true until maybe the last year. And the last couple of years, I've probably been involved in this for about 3 years, so I was a little bit early. But it's actually growing into kind of a geek movement, I think.
Since we're on GeekSpeak, let's talk about the digital realm with copyright.
I have just a general question about copyright. What media does copyright cover?
Well, that's a good point. Copyrights are the expression of an idea. They're not the idea itself. So as a result, copyrights won't include things like, say, the phone book. As a matter of fact, there have been phone companies who have tried to copyright phone books and keep other people from making phone books, but that's flat out. That doesn't work. It doesn't include things like trademarks. So, for instance, Disney would still have the trademark to Mickey Mouse even if he had gone into the public domain. And it doesn't include patents. Patents are the way that you protect ideas. So within that range... As new technology comes along, it's kind of interesting. For a while, there was a question as to whether or not computer software or computer object code would be covered under copyright, and it was really only made clear in the 1976 Copyright Act.
And was it, or was it?
It was covered before that, but 1976 made it clear that it was covered.
Okay.
Now, why would it be copyrighted instead of patented? Isn't it an invention?
Well, again, it goes into the idea that you're covering the expression, not the facts themselves.
Okay.
And so if I'm creating a patent, that's supposed to be a new, unique, novel idea that is not obvious to members who are expert in that realm. And let's face it, most programs aren't like that. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that I want to be able to say, write a program and then have anyone be able to copy it and make money off of it.
Okay. I just want to clarify all that before we start laying down everything we're going to talk about.
It almost seems stifling, you know, anybody who wants to get involved in something creative.
Well, I mean,
who owns what rights?
They're actually there to protect those who are trying to be creative. But yeah. I understand what you mean. It does seem very constrictive.
So what if you inadvertently step on a copyright law?
Well, copyright, that's rather difficult. That's kind of like being in your English class and writing an essay that's exactly the same as someone else in the classes. It's really not going to happen all that often to have something that's so close that you mistake it.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, I don't think realistically you really have to worry about copyright. Copyright allows for independent invention. Two different people can come up with the same expression, you know, if it's simplistic enough. What you do have, the area that you're concerned about is patents, and that's probably a topic for a whole other show.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so how does digital content, after the law in 76, that took care of software. That's not all digital content. What about a book that I publish only through digital means?
Right. Well, this actually gets into, for a long time, there was no distinction between digital content versus other parts, and I should actually use the word no. I should put some qualifiers on this. Remember back at the beginning I said the copyright law code was extremely complex. So I'm going to speak in some generalities here.
Okay, that's fine.
It's very complex. 1992 was really the first time that we started seeing a legal difference between digital media, as it were. This is the Digital Home Recording Act, And you might recall back the DAT machines, when they were made, there was a law passed that required them to have a serial copy management system, SCM. And in this case, the music industry, the publishers, were afraid that people would make lots of digital copies of their music. They're still afraid of that, by the way. And so they got this special law passed saying that at consumer levels, any recorders that you bought had to have this special copy protection built in. And that's really, 1992 was the first time that we started seeing a legal difference between all normal forms of copyright and digital copyright.
Okay, so it kind of split at that point.
Yeah.
People started thinking about it a different way. Well, why, from a geeky sense, why is digital different than the book that I published?
Well, actually, I think that the law actually made a big mistake. And maybe it's just our post-internet explosion way of looking at it. But what they really were concerned with was digital medium itself. And I think that most of the laws that are aimed specifically at digital media are probably wrong. What they were concerned about was digital distribution. So you understand the difference.
Right.
That, you know, digital media could be source code or it could be a song or it could be anything. Digital distribution essentially is the internet and the World Wide Web and everything that goes along with that.
So basically what happened is that these companies are making a lot of money on producing copyrighted material and holding that 95-year ownership of that copyrighted material. They're concerned that with the ease of digital transferring information in the digital age, that they felt the only way to solve this problem was to start jumping back into like the hardware side of it and trying to put in some kind of restriction at the...
To tell you the truth, I'm not going to guess too much at their motives, but
okay.
I will actually state that there is one thing that you can look at, and that is about 6 or 7 times we've had big waves in the last 100 years where some new technology has come along and the existing copyright holders have said, oh no, this is going to kill us, you got to stop it, you got to throttle it.
An example? Besides the digital.
Oh yeah, one. So actually radio, since we're on the radio, that's a good example. The record producers were sure that the broadcasting radio was going to just absolutely kill their radio sales, their music sales.
Because people are giving away for free.
That's right. And so, as you know, nowadays they pay music stations to play their music so they can advertise.
Not here on KSB, thank you very much.
Right, exactly. Uh-huh. Then the another example, for instance, was the VCR. This is another famous one. Valenti, the head of the Motion Picture Association of America, I think, MPAA, was quoted in a famous quote saying that the VCR is like a woman home alone with a Boston Strangler. And he was sure that it was going to kill the industry. And that ultimately resulted in a 1984 Supreme Court decision, which was known as Sony versus Universal. And that was where they essentially decided that, yes, a VCR could be used to make illegal copies, but there's enough value to the VCR as a whole that it's legal for people to have that. So this came out to, this was a decision on fair use and a general concept that I think actually serves our technology very well, which is, yeah, Napster can be used and has been used to steal a lot of songs, but if that technology has substantial non-infringing uses, is the legal term, then that technology is still worthwhile and shouldn't be banned or made illegal. So that that was an important decision. And obviously, now that more than half of the movies' profits come from VCRs, I'm sure that they're very glad that we didn't allow them to kill it off.
And of course, radio didn't hurt the music industry at all.
That's right. And same thing with TVs and movies. The introduction of cable TV systems. I mean, it's a very common refrain that the copyright holders say new technology is going to kill us off, and then they actually make a profit out of it.
And it happens again and again. So I take it that we're not at a stagnant point at this time with copyright. It's changing and up for change all the time. Is that right?
Well, in a sense. I'll talk more about that a little bit, but the take-home point on this is that 10 years ago, the people came off and said, oh, this new technology is going to kill us off. And this time they had enough congressional influence that Congress listened and started passing laws. And some of the more recent laws, the 1982 one, or the 1992 one, had its bad points, but the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, is much worse.
And we'll talk about that in just a minute. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room, we have Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, John Tracy, and special guest Michael McKay, a consumer advocate focusing on copyright laws. We're going to be getting into legalities and some of the bills that are up for debate soon on GeekSpeak. But I'd like to welcome you all to join the discussion. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. You're welcome to call in with questions or comments about the subject. Again, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo. We're on the web at kosp.org. My name's Lyle Troxell, and we're back to copyright laws. Hi, Michael. So, you were saying.
Right. So, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was a very large bill, but it essentially was based on one primary copyright principle. That copyright principle was every copy is an illegal copy unless it's explicitly allowed by the copyright holder. So, that means that a computer, for instance, would be a natural copyright infringer because, you know, you've got the hard disk copy, you've got it going over the bus, you've got it in the processor, you may have it in the cache of the processor.
Did the Digital Millennium Copyright Act have anything defining what a copy is?
Oh, well, I'll get to that in a moment. But this was the philosophy behind the DMCA, that any copy is an illegal copy. Now, this doesn't actually even pass the smell test, my way of thinking. For instance, by that rule, if I'm reading a book and I have glasses, my glasses make a copy of the words as I'm reading them, and that's an illegal copy. So if you really take a look at what they're really saying, it was a ridiculous concept. However, to take a step back, here's the way that copyright laws have been made in the last 100 years. They've been too complicated for Congress to do it. So what happens is a bunch of what we'll call stakeholders, so copyright publishers, research librarians, whoever, get together at a convention and say, okay, here's the current issues, let's fight over these things and come up with some compromise.
Is there a consumer representative there?
No. As a matter of fact, there isn't.
That's interesting. And
so what they'll do is typically the copyright holders will say, well, we have always had the right that every copy is an illegal copy, to use an example. But they'll come up with some sweeping, broad generalization like that. And then instead of people standing up and saying, that's ridiculous, get out of town, what they'll do is they'll say, oh, so maybe I'm the research librarian. So I say, well, okay, maybe every copy is an illegal copy. However, I want to have an exception for research librarians and archival purposes. So the DMCA has an exception in it that says, we can research certain things if an archivist library. And then the software people stand up and say, well, we need to have the rights to do reverse engineering. So they'll put an exception in for reverse engineering and just for software programs, but not for anything else, and so on and so on. So typically the way that it works then is that the person who asserts the first grand sweeping principle always gets that to happen, and then everyone else just kind of carps and carves off their little parts that work. What this typically does is means that anyone who's not at the convention effectively gets taken out of the game. The interesting part about that is obviously people are not represented here. In theory, Congress is supposed to represent them, but in practice, sometimes they add a few more exceptions. But for the last 100 years, they haven't had a good track record at really working with this. And up to about 76... the people who got disadvantaged by these laws, I'm trying not to use an Anglo-Saxon term for this, usually were not the general public as much, but they were, for instance, the 1914 Copyright Act, the movie studios were not a big power and did not participate in that. So as a result, when the law came out, they were at a severe disadvantage. Well, they found out about this, and then they started lobbying their congressmen, And then the result was that it took a long time to get the law passed. The 1976 law actually started in 1949, to give you an idea of this. So you would think that these guys would get smart and would actually make the laws more reasonable in the first place, but somehow they just haven't learned their lesson. Back to the DMCA, the grand sweeping principle that every copy was an illegal copy got enshrined into that basic law. And what came out of that was the concept that they needed to protect digital items, and they had to make figuring out how something worked illegal. So,
wait. I'm sorry. So they made a law that was very restrictive on what is, well, assuming everything by default is kind of an illegal copy. And then they said, well, we got to start protecting that, and the only way to really protect that is to make it illegal to actually try to figure out how to copy something?
Yeah, okay. I did take two leaps there.
Yeah, it's kind of two leaps. Okay.
All right. So what they decided was that we had to mandate some copy protection back like they did in the 1992 law, but they wanted to make it illegal to break that copy protection. So they wrote a sweeping law, and it's basically, it breaks down into two parts. One part is whether or not you can actually circumvent a copy protection measure, and the second part is whether or not you can tell people about that copy protection measure circumvention that you've done.
And this is wrapped up in the new sweeping law of the Digital Millennium Act, right?
That's okay. Right. So the problem was, is that it was very full of stuff that was good to the copyright holders. So the MPA and the RIA really liked this particular law, but they didn't really put any safeguards into it. So an example of this is that the definition of what a copy protection is wide open. So I could, for instance, a famous computer term is ROT 13. It's basically flipping bits around. And that, as far as the DMCA is concerned, is adequate copy protection, and it's illegal for you to break that. It's wow. Also illegal for you to distribute how to break it to other people.
So it's kind of restricting information.
Yeah. Now, they gave a lot of little exceptions in here. And so one of them, for instance, was encryption research. Being a cryptographer, that's near and dear to my heart. So it is legal for you to circumvent, but it is not legal for you to distribute the circumvention.
In any way, even telling people.
Yeah, for purposes of encryption research. Wow. So this actually got into, you might have heard the time that Professor Felton of Princeton was invited as part of a public scheme to crack some watermarks on the Secure Digital Music Initiative, SDMI. And then he went to publish it, and the RIA sent him a letter saying that he would be sued under the DMCA if he actually published the methods of breaking the watermark, because that would be he would be disseminating a circumvention method. So it was okay that he circumvented in the first place because that was covered under the research clause.
What about his free speech?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is academic free speech. It goes down to one of the core rights of right. You know, the First Amendment. And so there was kind of a flap. What eventually ended up happening was that the RIA withdrew the threat. They went to court, and the court, there's something called a prior judgment, I think it is, where you essentially say, I know you're going to sue me, so I'm going to take this to court in advance.
Right.
And the judge essentially threw out the case saying, well, they've withdrawn the suit. So,
right.
Despite the fact
so no judgment
that they
on
would
it.
Do it again.
Miles, yeah. You had a point?
Yeah, just for the audience, if they feel like they're getting lost at this point, because there's a whole lot of information coming through here, to put it into context that's simple that a lot of people can grasp, something that's dear and true to their hearts, if the Digital Millennium Copyright Act were in effect in 1980, that was 20 years ago, the IBM clones that we all use today would not be able to exist.
Why is that?
Because Phoenix BIOS, the original clone BIOS, what they did was they took IBM's chipset. They had an engineer look at it, see like what all of its inputs and outputs were, see how that works, then pass it off to another group so that, you know, if he wasn't involved, so that no one who was actually involved in the making or the internals of the IBM BIOS chip was working, and had this other team re-engineer it to make a what's called a clean room version of the BIOS. And that's what allowed manufacturers like Compaq to...
A competitor to IBM.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So basically, if this this law had been in effect 20 years ago, nobody... Compaq would have been sued out of existence before it ever made its first clone PC.
Yeah. That's,
and we wouldn't have home computers the way they are today.
Yeah, that's correct. Let me just clarify that with one little technical nitpicking point. This is Geek Speak, so I think we can do that. And that is that they are still allowed to reverse engineer it, but what would have been illegal was for them to break the copy protection that protected the code. So that's actually one of the great catch-22s of the DMCA, is that there are things that are legal for you to do, but the copyright holders can protect it and keep you from doing that, and all of a sudden it becomes illegal to break it. So an example is, it's perfectly legal for me to take a DVD and to copy it to a VCR cassette for purposes of, say, you know, if I don't
archiving
it, or if I don't have a DVD player in my other room, I can do that. However, it is illegal for me to break the copy protection that keeps me
from making
that copy. So what's happened is the copyright has a whole bunch of checks and balances that have been built into it.
And it's totally surpassed.
Yeah, within the passage of the DMCA, they've essentially said, hey, they can. The thing was, is that when they wrote that anti-circumvention clause, they didn't say you can only use that anti-circumvention clause in this way.
Right.
They just said
it was broad.
Yeah, go to it.
We got a call from Regal of San Jose. He was just at Comdex down in Las Vegas last week, and he heard a lot of conversations about DVD and CD tech regarding copying issues. And so it's high in the realm of the tech world. Comdex, of course, is the biggest technology show that exists, even though it's shrinking every year. So thank you, Regal, for the comment. Sean, you had a comment?
Yeah, this is taking copyright back in another direction, and I hate to do this, but we're running short on time. But there's people who actually want to copyright their works. Where do they go to get information, and how's that, you know, done?
Oh, it's the you'll find the copyright information. It's part of the U.S. PTO.gov, Patent Trademark Office.
Okay. And is that a pretty easy, is that a simple process?
Actually, by default, you have a copyright on your item. 1976, they got rid of the need to register your copyrights. And so by
default... You just declare it yourself?
Yeah, so by default, it's copyrighted. And,
interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, we're running out of time quickly. Why don't we pass out some information, some URLs. I didn't write them down. You have some of them, Michael, some URLs on the top of your head that people can... more interested in this issue could go and learn
about.
Yeah,
I would say digitalconsumer.org is, I think, one of the best sites that just talks a little bit about how what we've talked about in theory here really affects your ability to do things like make copies, or, for instance, if you were to buy an ebook and want to sell it to someone else,
Where
the publishers are trying to stop you from doing that.
Digitalconsumer.org.
Yeah.
And you can also find out a couple other URLs on Geekspeak, geekspeak.org. We have some information about that. Michael, I want to thank you very much. I know that we run out of time. We'll have to do another show about this because we didn't even get to some of the bills that are pending. But there's at least a couple really scary ones. Can you give an example of a scary bill that's pending?
Yeah. The real bad one is called Consumer Broadband and Digital Promotion Act, or CBDPA. And this bill is essentially designed to mandate copy protection in everything that you anything that handles digital medium. So digital cameras, televisions, projectors, monitors, microphones, anything that deals with digital signals need to have digital copy protection. And it's all set up with the idea that the only reason why you'd do something like this would be it's mass-produced media as opposed to stuff that you would produce on your own. So it's a far-reaching attempt to control.
And it doesn't have very much support and probably won't pass, but other ones could come down the line in that same vein.
And it's co-sponsored by our Senator Dianne Feinstein, so everyone in the listening audience, go, you know, talk to your senator.
Yeah.
We're going to have to do another topic on this. We are completely out of time. Next week, we're going to be back. We're going to be talking about well, geeks, your questions. We're going to be answering your questions regarding your computers and technical questions you may have. That's next week at 6:30. Stay tuned now for Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. My name is Lyle Troxell, in the air room with Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, John Tracy, and, of course, Michael McKay, consumer advocate, copyright information. And thank you, Maggie, for answering the phones. Thank you, for callers, for joining in Geek Speak. Without you, it would just be Geek Talk, and no one wants to listen to that. Till next week, this has been Lyle Troxell on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo. We're on the web at kosp.org. Two Steps from the Blues with Charlie Lang, but first, Stardate. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at seagate.com.
Stardate, November 25th. If you're feeling a bit jovial today, perhaps it's related to the sky. The planet Jupiter is climbing into the evening sky, and tonight it appears just a few degrees from the moon. They rise in late evening, and Jupiter looks like a brilliant star just to the moon's lower right. They're even closer together at first light tomorrow, when they stand high in the sky. To ancient sky watchers, the planets were more than just bright moving points of light in the night. They were the embodiments of the gods. Jupiter was the king of the Roman gods. He was also known as Jove, and that's where we get the old exclamation,